into upside down thinking. Mark, we're talking about not being separate and creating matter through our consciousness. And maybe it matter doesn't exist except through our perception that it does. Help us with that.
I think that's really the key point, perception. That the world that we experience is one through the lens of our perceptual systems, through our eyes, our ears, our nose, our mouth, sense of touch. We know those are limited. We know, for example, that the eyes only show us a sliver of the electromagnetic spectrum. There's all kinds of light that we don't see, X-rays, infrared light. Our eyes don't show us that. So we just should remember that our eyes are our limitation in many ways. But when we think about our own experience, and people who I mentioned in the book, like Rupert Spira, really get into this idea that everything is inherently subjective. We view reality as being out there, that there is an objective world that exists independently of any consciousness. And that's exactly what I'm challenging. But if we look even at our own experience, how do we experience the objective world? We experience it through our own lens of consciousness. We experience the objectivity subjectively. So when we really get into it, we kind of have to reverse our perceptual system, which shows us an out there, and it's so convincing. And yet that perceptual system is something that we are subjectively experiencing.
So I think you use an example about touching your arm. Wait, help us with that. So,
yes. So if you think about like a tree is one example that I use. If you touch a tree and think about where the experience of that sensation exists, it's existing within your consciousness. So if you kind of close your eyes and touch the tree, you realize it's just a sensation. And the same thing with hearing something. It's a sensation that is occurring within your consciousness. Your body and your thoughts, basically everything material, is some kind of an experience that you're having right here, right now, within your field of consciousness, which your body and your perceptual system has developed an interpretation for, which says, oh, that is a tree that I'm touching. And we're so quick to register that. But really, it's just an experience.
We love to name things.
Yeah, we love to name things. But if we get back to the simplest version of what's occurring, it's always an experience within our own consciousness.
So even memory is the same thing. It's just in our consciousness.
Thoughts.
So let's get into, I know that you give so many examples within your work and within this book. And you even talk about how probably more than 30 prestigious universities have done all sorts of experiments in parapsychology or in this kind of phenomenon, whether it's remote viewing or near-death experience or telekinesis or telepathy or any of these things. These experiments have been replicated. But they're still not accepted as valid somehow. It just boggles the mind. Like, for example, somebody that we've interviewed many times, Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, and he has done many extraordinary experiments, and yet he's been derided in many ways. I think Richard Dawkins is one person that has just taken it upon himself to just sort of negate the work of Rupert Sheldrake. And so tell us about that and what's going on. And even if you look up in Wikipedia, how there's a bias there. So tell us about that.
It's an amazing dynamic that I was not aware of. Because as I got into the research, I was wondering, how is it that there's so much evidence and I've never heard of it? I mean, I studied psychology. We never talked about these things. There was a lab at Princeton University where I went to undergrad. It was a lab run by the former dean of engineering for 27 years that was going on while I was there, and I didn't know it existed. They studied these phenomena like psychokinesis, mind on affecting matter, remote viewing. So there is a real bias to, I think, sweep these things under the rug or regard them as being fallacious in some way or some kind of the experiments aren't done properly. And that's the kind of rhetoric that one might read if you look up psychokinesis or telepathy on Wikipedia. What I'm learning is that there is a momentum against these phenomena. And I'm not exactly sure if there's a single reason for it, or maybe just many. And one reason might be that we are challenging here many paradigms. We're challenging the materialist paradigm with the reality of these phenomena. Materialism would predict that these things are impossible. So for those who have spent entire careers saying that the universe works in a materialistic fashion, these are big challenges. And so there might be just a tendency for one to reject evidence that doesn't conform to one's existing beliefs.
So we may be in a period of time, just like in Galileo's time when he said, hey, the Earth is not the center of the universe. And people just laughed at him or refused to even let him show how that's true or look through the telescope. And so here we are in that kind of major, as it's been described, Copernicus shift in scientific thought.
I think we're at that. It's that level of revolution where it's such a big shift in thinking that there is a resistance. And with Galileo, he had all of his evidence in his telescope, and there were clergymen that didn't want to look in the telescope. So I think there is a bit of that dynamic happening right now where people don't want to look in the telescope.
And there's very little funding then, therefore, available for this research, even though it does go on. And that's what you pulled out in your book, so much of it. And if somebody said debunks it as, okay, some of this is false and it's not good science. But with so many universities participating and so many very, very respected scientists participating and the replication of so many experiments, it's hard to say, wait, there's a conspiracy that all these people are coming up with bad science here?
That's my reasoning as well. And I think we're starting to see slight momentum. So for example, the American Psychological Association's journal, The American Psychologist, published an article in 2018 by Dr. Etzel Cardenya, which looks at the accumulated evidence for these phenomena and shows that there is a statistical effect beyond what chance would predict. This is a mainstream peer-reviewed journal that accepted the article. I don't think many people necessarily know about this, but that might start to catch on. And I'll give you a good example. I received an email recently of a college student at a prominent U.S. university who was attending a lecture on science by a prominent scientist. The whole lecture was on how beliefs in ESP and things like it are totally bogus and that there's no evidence at all. And the student actually had read my book and stood up in class and said, are you familiar with the studies that have been done by the many universities that you just mentioned? And he said he wasn't aware of the studies. So I think what's happening in some cases is maybe it's not malicious. It's just not knowing that there is even evidence because it's been so swept under the rug. And I'm hoping with studies like Dr. Cardenya's, it will start to get out there.
Well, even let's say like, all right, let's go to healthcare and the study of epigenetics and DNA and genes and changing our genes and affecting our health through meditation and that sort of thing. So this is really coming down to where people are physically affected, and there are enough people that are taking in this information and they're starting to behave in different ways, even looking at their belief systems and how, and their sense of stress and so forth and how it affects their body. Seems to me like that might help to move this along.
I agree with you. I think when it gets to one's personal well-being, people start to pay attention. And Dr. Bruce Lipton has been a pioneer in this area of looking at the effect of the mind and our beliefs on our physical health. And what we're learning more and more is that the mind plays a real effect on the physical world. It has a role to play, which is not what would be predicted by the conventional models of materialism.
Exactly.
Under that model, the brain produces consciousness. Consciousness has no effect on anything physical.
Exactly. There you go. So I know that you've mentioned Dean Radin, Dr. Dean Radin of the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and who has also been a guest on New Dimensions many times. And say something about in the entanglement and his double slit experiments.
Yes. So he's been a real pioneer as well. And those are two separate topics. And they're both really important.
Yes.
One is the concept of entanglement, which, to simplify it, it's an idea in quantum physics where you have two physically distant particles. So one's here, one's very far away in space and time. And when you affect one, the other one is affected at the same instant, as if there's an instantaneous invisible connection. Einstein didn't like this. He called it spooky action at a distance.
He did acknowledge it. So that's when he gave it that term. I love that term, spooky action at a distance. But he didn't explain it, but he did acknowledge it.
He acknowledged it. But the reason he didn't like it is that he thought the speed of light was the fastest that anything could travel. And yet here we have an instantaneous reaction, which is faster than the speed of light.
And at a distance, that these things just change. If they were once associated, then they're always associated, and they just flip and change.
It's totally immediately. And it's counterintuitive, but there seems to be some kind of an invisible connection. And people like Dr. Dean Radin have maybe said, well, it could apply to the mind. So Dean Radin wrote a book called Entangled Minds, which could explain psychic phenomena potentially through this concept of entanglement.
And now tell us about his double slit experiment.
This is a really, really important one. The double slit experiment, to simplify what the implications of it are, is when the observer is looking at the experiment, a particle behaves differently. Just by the act of observing, the particle behaves like a particle, whereas when no one is looking at it, it behaves like a wave of probabilities, meaning it's maybe here, maybe there. That's not like a particle that has a definite location. So this has boggled the minds of physicists for a long time. What is causing this? How is it possible that the particle's behaving differently just depending on whether or not someone's observing it? And some people have said, well, consciousness plays a role. And there's a whole group of quantum physicists who say it's because of consciousness. And others say, well, there are other explanations that it's not a consciousness. So Dean Radin has decided to study this, where he asked people to put their mind to the experiment at a distance. So he's isolating the variable of consciousness. The only thing that's changing is that someone is putting their mental attention to the machine at a distance or not. And what he's found is that there is a very slight but highly statistically significant effect on the experiment, on whether it behaves like a wave or a particle, which is completely brilliant. And I think this is the kind of thing that should win a Nobel Prize if it's replicated.
Exactly. I think the first time I heard this concept that the observer will have an effect on what is observed was years ago with Fridtjof Capra, who is also a physicist and wrote the book The Tao of Physics. And I remember when he first mentioned it, it just like boggled my mind. And I thought, oh, okay. This is very interesting. This has implications on many, many levels. I'm here with Mark Gober, and he is the author of An End to Upside Down Thinking, Dispelling the Myth that the Brain Produces Consciousness and the Implications for Everyday Life. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. I'm here with Mark Gober. He's the author of an extraordinary collection of research and information about a new paradigm in science, that consciousness is at the ground level of it all. And the book is called An End to Upside Down Thinking, Dispelling the Myth that the Brain Produces Consciousness and the Implications for Everyday Life. So, Mark, I'd like to talk about the implications for everyday life. So what does this mean for us if we really start to take in and start to really understand that consciousness is the fundamental source of the universe rather than matter? What does that mean for us?
For me, one of the biggest shifts has been in how I view life and death and meaning. The conventional perspective, as we discussed, says once the brain dies, it's over. So life is finite, has a finite period, and there's no real meaning beyond what you can rationalize. What we see in what I think the evidence points toward is the notion that consciousness isn't dependent on the body, and therefore when the body ceases to function, the consciousness itself does not die. That has huge implications for how we think about everything. If this life is just kind of an experience of consciousness that is temporary as this experience, but not the end of consciousness itself, then I think we might recontextualize our lives. And maybe if we have a fear of death that is deep in our subconscious or maybe not deep in our subconscious, maybe we wouldn't fear death as much. And then how might we live if we don't think death is the end? For me, that's been transformative, and I think it's still working its way through my system. But for many people that I've spoken with, it really shifts things.
Well, I noticed that I've been privileged and honored to be at the death of several loved ones and to be with them in that moment as they pass on. And the doctors might describe, oh, death is, oh, they're going to die in this terrible way, and it's going to be awful, and give all these warnings. But the people that I have experienced this phenomenon with, they all had a kind of philosophy that life does go on, that for somehow they are just holding it in a different way. They didn't go into their dying in a fearful way. And all of those deaths were really easy. That transition was just so easy. And then I hear other people talking about how people who are afraid of death and think, okay, this is the end of it all. I remember years ago, Michael said, when B.F. Skinner, the psychologist of Skinner Box and everything, I think it was B.F. Skinner, who said he didn't believe in consciousness going on after death. And I remember Michael, I remember exactly where I was when he said this. We were just going across the Golden Gate Bridge and at the toll booth, and Michael said, boy, isn't he going to be surprised? He had just died, and Michael said, boy, isn't he going to be surprised? And that's just an idea of that consciousness does go on. And those of us that maybe resist that might have a harder time letting go of this physical incarnation.
Absolutely. And if we go back to the analogy of the sun and the clouds, it's like the death of the physical body is a release of many of the clouds that are blocking us from perceiving this broader reality. And we see it in the near-death experience where people are hovering over their bodies and experiencing unconditional love and generally, not always, but generally very positive things during this time of almost no bodily function. That might give us a window into what happens when we die. We can't say for sure because the person didn't actually die, but we see a generally very pleasant experience. One experience that really has stuck with me is known as the life review that people talk about in the near-death experience, where they're seeing their whole life in a flash. They're judging themselves for how they acted towards people. They're not judging themselves for how much money they made or what kind of car they drove. It's how they treated other people. And sometimes events that seemed insignificant were actually very significant in the life review. In some cases, the life review is experienced through the eyes of those that the person affected. So let's say Bob is in a near-death experience having his life review. He recalls an event where he was really mean to someone named Sarah. He might have experienced that event through Sarah's eyes in the life review. Comes back into his body after he's resuscitated and typically is forever changed. So if this is a glimpse into what happens after physical death, it not only provides a potentially happy picture of consciousness post-physical life, but it also provides a new perspective on meaning.
That reminds me of a just fabulous movie that I'll tell you about in our listeners if you haven't seen it. It's an older movie in the 90s with Meryl Streep and Albert Brooks, and it's called Defending Your Life. And it's all about that life review. She has a great life, and she just has done all these wonderful things, and then he has not such a great life. He hasn't lived it so great. And it's just a wonderful take on that life review that you were just talking about. And I'm just thinking also, Mark, when you talk about all of these life reviews and near death and everything, what about certain psychic mediums that are able to talk to people who have already died? And they say something about that, and that's an interesting phenomena.
Well, if we accept consciousness as being the fundamental medium of reality, it's not dependent on a body, then it would make sense, at least conceptually, that one could communicate with that form of consciousness or that sliver of consciousness that is no longer in a body. And that's what the evidence seems to suggest as well. And there have been many cases, some dating back to the 1800s, of people who had an ability to really communicate with the deceased in ways that we cannot explain. But more recently, and I think this is maybe some of the more compelling scientific stuff for those who want to see studies, is the Winbridge Research Center has been studying mediums. These are people who claim they can communicate with the deceased under controlled quintuple blind conditions, so five levels of blinding, where the medium is over the phone speaking to the researcher, and all the medium gets is the first name of the deceased person. The researcher over the phone then asks a series of questions, and what the studies show is that the medium is able to get information about that deceased person just by knowing the first name beyond what chance would predict.
So that says something is going on beyond that materialist science there, right there. And I'm also thinking about people who do, and Larry Dossey has worked with this, and others have worked with this. And I remember when I first met Michael, my partner, more than 45 years ago, he was working with something called Mind Dynamics, which was a precursor to the EST, and even Werner Erhard was part of that whole thing. And what he was doing at the time was doing remote healing. And he would sit down, and I would watch him do a session where he'd sit down. He wouldn't know the person he was healing or working with, and he would do this whole healing session with someone remotely. And it seemed to have some sort of effect. So that's another one where we can actually think of a person and actually send. We talk about, oh, I'll send you healing energy, you know, but we actually can do that.
Yeah, there seems to be evidence for this phenomenon. It's known as energy healing, and it depends on who the healer is, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't seem to work. But there have been some studies that I mentioned that in the book that have been done at places like Penn State, and some credible people seem to show that the mental intentions of a person can have an effect on another person's physical form, which, again, it kind of makes sense if we buy into this idea that consciousness is primary. If we shift the consciousness, then it would make sense that the physical material could also shift, including the body.
What about, let's say, group meditation? Let's say a group takes a particular moment in time and they decide that they will all focus on some sort of world peace or something. Have there been any studies on that, and has that been effective in any way?
I have heard of some studies that seem to show a correlation between group meditation and world events. It is difficult, of course, to isolate what is causing the shift because there are so many variables. What's happening in the world, is it because of that meditation group, or are there other variables that are causing the shift in the world? But I think some of the studies done by the researchers from Princeton University, they have a program called the Global Consciousness Project, which has random number generators distributed around the world. So these are machines that spit out zeros and ones in a random fashion. What they find is that when there's a major global event in which they think people would have an emotional response to, like 9/11 or Princess Diana's death, those machines start to behave non-randomly.
So
the people aren't even necessarily aware that there is a machine This is just what's happening to the machines based on a world event. So they look at what happens to the machines under typical situation where there's no major event, and then they compare it to the string of zeros and ones when there is a major event. There seems to be a statistical effect where it's maybe slightly more ones than zeros.
So people's emotional bodies and their emotional makeup or chemistry or whatever that is focused on the same thing at the same time worldwide, and an inordinate amount of ones that would not come up otherwise.
Exactly. And it takes some math to do that, to look at the statistics to see that there's a difference.
Mark, we are out of time. I can't stand it. We've just barely touched this. So I've just been enjoying our conversation so much with Mark Gober, and he's the author of An End to Upside Down Thinking, Dispelling the Myth that the brain produces consciousness and the implications for everyday life. And in order to know more about him and his work, his podcasts, and anything else you want to know, look for his resources on his website, Mark Gober, G-O-B as in boy, G-O-B-E-R.com. Or you can get there through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You've been listening to New Dimensions. This is program number 3664.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the donate button. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcasts and find over 1,000 hours of audio dialogues in our searchable archive. New Dimensions is produced by New Dimensions Radio in Santa Rosa, California, USA. Our executive producer is Justine Willis-Toms. Our post-production editor is Lou Judson. For over four decades, New Dimensions has been producing weekly conversations at the leading edge. We sincerely thank all of you who have supported us by being members of Friends of New Dimensions, as well as members of our affiliate stations. My name is Dan Drayson. On behalf of everyone at New Dimensions, whose endeavors make this program possible, I'm wishing you well. New Dimensions Radio is an independent producer supported by listener contributions. To find out more about the program you've just heard, to subscribe to our free weekly newsletter and our New Dimensions and New Dimensions Cafe podcasts, and to access thousands of other programs in the New Dimensions archive, please visit our website, newdimensions.org. That's newdimensions.org. Or call us at 707-468-5215. That's 707-468-5215. Please join us next time as we explore New Dimensions. New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Aloha, I'm Hope Johnson, miracle-minded mystic and founder of Miracle Botanicals. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about the wisdom of A Course in Miracles for daily life.
Listen to music and podcasts from CGSF 90.1 FM with our radio app. It's on-the-go listening made easy. You can tune into all our music, spoken word, and multicultural shows using your device. Our app lets you set reminders so you'll never miss your favorite show again. Stay connected to CGSF 90.1 FM through our community radio app. Download the app from the Apple Store or get it on Google Play.
Hi there, this is Jan Arden, and if you're listening to something fabulous, Well, you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, Simon Fraser University Radio, streaming on the internet at cjsf.ca.
This is broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain.
You're listening to CJ.